Welcome to the second annual, first annual.
Yeah, it's
the Bald Move Award Show. It's, I think, going to be called, for lack of creativity, the Baldies.
Terrible name.
Last year we had the 2014 Bald Move Consensus Two Hosts Top 10.
This is how all good award shows start out, by the way, talking about how bad the name of the award show is.
So last year, you know, our top 10 was starting from the bottom and working our way up. Silicon Valley, Orange is the New Black, The Americans, House of Cards, Boardwalk Empire, Fargo, Mad Men, The Leftovers, Game of Thrones, True Detective. Lots of turnover in our top 10 this year. And we're not going to... This podcast you're listening to right now is the end result of hours and hours of deliberations, which we filmed every bit of it.
Yeah.
And if you're a premium member, you can check it out. So if you want to know why something was rated or why something won or why something didn't get the coverage, it's probably covered in our, the behind the scenes stuff.
Sure.
So
also, it's a format change for this year, right? We don't have a single top 10 list. We're doing categories.
We got comedies
and
dramas.
We're doing pools of nominees and one winner.
We got actors, male and female. We've got biggest disappointments, biggest surprises. We got a lot more categories, and it's a lot more complicated. We should probably jump right into it. We also got this out a full month earlier than last year. So progress.
Really? It came out in February last time?
It's like no end of January. Like, man. Maybe January 30th.
Damn. All right.
But let's talk about the best debut/pilot of 2015. The nominees were Mr. Robot on the USA Network.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The great... up-and-coming USA
Bastion
Network.
Of dramatic television. Netflix's Narcos, about the life of Pablo Escobar. And HBO's David Simon joint, Show Me Hero. Also on Netflix, Daredevil and Better Call Saul.
Okay.
Our winner is Better Call Saul.
It all feels very artificial. Yes, yes, it was Better
does.
Call Saul.
So this is a tricky top. This is and you might notice some lack of cohesion amongst other categories. But when we're talking about the best debut, it came down for us, Better Call Saul and Mr. Robot, and we thought Better Call Saul was the more even, more mature, more polished product,
and something that kind of stands alone in a better way than something like a Mr. Robot or.
Yeah,
House of Cards. Like, it can't rely, obviously, on any future stuff. Although, yeah, I don't know. There's some promise
it does have seasons 1 through 5 of Breaking Bad.
That's not future stuff. But what I'm trying to say is, like, a show like Mr. Robot has some grand ideas that promise things in its future that give it a lot more than other shows, but Better Call Saul is just so good across the board. Minor misstep, but come on, Mr. Robot has one of those too.
Yep.
I felt like Better Call Saul doesn't need to rely on what it could possibly do in the future.
Sure.
Because it's so good in its present.
Yeah, and you got to wonder if when the Villigan and Gould sat down, if they... I think the big misstep is episode 1 and 2, the 1-2 punch of introducing the series. And I wonder if they went too far down the nostalgia, like, oh, we really need to get these beloved characters from, we need to ground this to Breaking Bad to get the Breaking Bad fans. I don't think that was necessary. In fact, it was a massive distraction.
Yeah.
But after they got that done that and settled down to the business of telling the story of this, you know, Saul Goodman, who we are introduced to as Jimmy McGill. Once they get to the nuts and bolts of telling that story, it's terrific. Has a lot of heart, a lot of comedy, obviously a lot of drama. I'm really interested in seeing them come back for 2016.
Me too.
Let's move on to the biggest surprise. The nominees were, and there's only four in this category, Mr. Robot, the Marvel Cinematic Universe on Netflix, which comprises Daredevil and Jessica Jones. So I guess we could have Daredevil and Jessica Jones as separate entries if we wanted to. Yeah. Better Call Saul and Netflix's Sense8. And the winner is Mr. Robot.
Sure. Who would have expected 2016, 2015, as a matter of fact?
You see this bug-eyed dude on a USA commercial, and it's about hackers. And
he's got a funny haircut.
I'm thinking, nope. Yep. Nope. Hard nope. Hard pass. And starting around episode 3 or 4, we started getting, you guys need to cover this. You know, and I remember, I think it was around episode 5, someone said, you guys are missing the boat on Mr. Robot the same way you missed the boat on True Detective season 1. I'm like, shit. That made me sit up and take notice, because that's one of my all-time podcasting regrets.
Yeah.
I finally got around to watching it as it was, I think, the same week that it was wrapping up. And again, like, I think I just made the case for it. It was on USA. It had a kind of goofy-looking dude. It was about computer hacking, something that not very many people have had success telling successful stories around that make people that are in the IT industry not roll their eyes.
Yeah. I think maybe the only bigger surprise could have been if, like, Better Call Saul was debuting on CW or something.
Or Better Call Saul sucked. I think that would be a big surprise. That's what really hurt it, because I expected, I don't know if I expected greatness, but I expected a very solid quality product. And I actually was delivered slightly more than that.
Yeah, so not really a surprise there. But yeah, Mr. Robot shocked me because the USA name. Like, that was the thing. Like, I don't expect anything from USA.
Yeah.
And they delivered, so.
Marvel Cinematic Universe on Netflix was also a big surprise for me, just because I expected to be mildly engaged and entertained by Daredevil and, like, low-stakes, Smallville kind of way, or a Gotham kind of way, and I was just blown away by the quality and the fact that I didn't give a shit at all about Jessica Jones, never even heard of her character, and that I got absorbed into that, and to the extent that I'm now excited for the rest of the stuff coming down the pike. They went from zero engagement with me to maximum engagement in the space of 24, 26 episodes of television?
Yeah.
We'll argue about why that should have been maybe 21 episodes later.
Maybe we have already argued about it.
it's hard to say that Mr. Robot wasn't the biggest surprise of the year.
Yeah.
Let's talk about some biggest disappointments in 2015. Easing our way into big topics.
Yeah.
Our nominees, if we had we had a field of 10, our nominees that made the final cut was Fear the Walking Dead, Spectre, out of nowhere a movie flies in, the 007 James Bond. Yeah, why this is the Baldies. Mm-hmm. Hello. House of Cards, Game of Thrones, and True Detective. And the winner, it's True Detective season 2.
It's got to be.
It's not.
Given that True Detective was number 1 on our list last time.
Yes.
You can't ignore how bad it was compared to season 1.
Yeah, and it was 16 this year.
Yeah.
That is a huge reversal of fortune for the show. And yeah, it's not that it was a bad show.
The hype was off the charts.
Yeah, I was so excited, and maybe this bit us in the ass, but we did this big, different kind of podcast for season 1, and I really enjoyed discussing that with you, and I came away with even a better appreciation for it. And then, again, it wasn't terrible, but it was kind of a mess.
I agree.
And, I thought the way it ended was okay. Like, again, I'm not saying I regretted my experience, and I'm still cautiously optimistic for season 3. But yeah, I can't say this is anything but a huge disappointment. Now, why did it speed out Fear the Walking Dead?
Because nobody had great expectations for that.
People were mildly excited about, ooh, let's see like some spectacle with the Los Angeles. And
the prospect of a fresh take on The Walking Dead.
They managed to sidestep all that and deliver just something that didn't work on almost any level.
Yeah, make no mistake, it was a disappointment. It just wasn't as nearly as big as
the delta the between number one our hopes and expectations and reality wasn't as big.
Yeah.
Why didn't Spectre win?
Because it's a movie. I don't care about it. We didn't really discuss it very much for Spectre, but
and House. Let's. What's the argument for House of Cards? House of Cards. My biggest regret is that it's coming back for a fourth season. Like, I think this could have been a really great it's one and done. It's the rise and fall of the House of Underwood. And by stretching out this final act into two seasons, it smacks of The Hobbit becoming three movies. It smacks of all this latest Hollywood fad of taking the last installment of something and breaking it up into two just to make money. It's just, it's dumb. And I don't know why Netflix is doing it, because it's not like they don't have a bevy of other hits to still have legs to go on. Really leery about season four of this coming up in February.
Yeah, but I think it just wasn't as big of a disappointment because it wasn't as good of a show to begin with.
Yeah.
As True Detective, so.
Game of Thrones edged out because while it did have a lot of disappointments and a lot of puzzling things, it also delivered the goods with episodes like Hard Home.
Yeah.
And it's hard to say that anything is a big disappointment, because that was one of... If you're ranking individual episodes, it might have cracked the top five, certainly the top 10 for this year.
Mm.
Another related disappointment, The Winds of Winter, the newest book from Martin.
It's an honorable mention.
Honorable mention. Highly anticipated coming out at least before the next season of Game of Thrones. He just made a big, long blog post on his saying that no. In fact, I'm not even sure it's going to come out in 2016.
The possibility that he's going to get the Lifetime Achievement
it could
Disappointment
be.
Award.
It could be. Because here's the thing, like, if there's going to be a flaming whip that makes George Martin write faster, it's probably the show catching up for him.
Mm-hmm.
Since that big, soft, hard, bit disappointing life milestone is about to occur, like, you know what I'm saying?
What incentives does he have going forward?
Yeah.
Sure. He's already disappointed everyone as much as he can. Go to
all the cons, write all the anthologies, edit all the cookbooks, whatever you want to do, George.
Yeah.
It's your world. We'll
see you on the other side of the show.
Yeah. Worst character of 2015.
Ah, that's a good one.
Lots of memorable characters. I'm going to do the full field just for shits and grins. No, I'm not. I'm gonna stick to discipline here. I'm going to do the top five. In no particular order, Chris, the teenage son from the other teenage son from Fear the Walking Dead.
Yeah, he's annoying.
All of the Alexandrians on The Walking Dead.
Mm-hmm.
Tyrell Wellick from Mr. Robot. The Sand Snakes.
The Scandinavian antagonist.
Whatever. Yeah. The arch Bond villain that had every affectation of every Bond villain of all times. The Sand Snakes with all their bad pousses. And the redhead twins from Jessica Jones. I think I fucked up and read the last one. The winner of the category is the redheaded twins from Jessica Jones.
Yeah, I cannot express how much I dislike these characters from the moment they appeared on the screen.
And unbelievably...
Even before they appeared on the actual screen.
Unbelievably, it's like the old joke about Liberace. It starts off pretty gay and just... Liberace taking his clothes off. It starts off gay and despite all belief, just keeps getting gayer.
Okay, I've not heard that.
You never heard that? Okay. No. Well, it's tasteless. I probably shouldn't even said it. Yeah, but these guys start off terrible.
Yeah.
And they just keep getting worse until the climax. They just about ruin the series.
Yeah, it's real bad what they do with those.
I know they're not eight free agents with their own free will. This is the writers trying to... I mean, this is the big problem with Jessica Jones is it's eight solid episodes that they stretch out to 12 or 13.
Yeah.
And the loops that they have to do to ensure that the big bad, you know, continues to be able to be a big bad, it just culminates with this just being a debacle. And you're right.
If you took the McPoyles out of It's Always Sunny
and
put them into Daredevil, this is what you would have, right? Like,
that is a pretty damn good comparison, man.
That's how I felt about them. Except they weren't meant to be funny. They were something.
They?
Maybe
think
they were
supposed
but...
to find the weird twin relationship they had amusing, but
no, I didn't. I found it
uncomfortable.
Yeah,
and annoying.
Yeah, I. Didn't like anything about them.
Pretty bad. Some honorable mentions. FBI agent Stan Beeman.
Yeah.
From The Americans.
We talked about how much you disliked him last year. This year they just went over the top with him.
I don't know. Because it's the guy next door. the big bad, I guess, living next door to the protagonist, who are actually kind of the villains, and Stan Beeman's kind of the hero, I guess, if you're looking at it with Patriot lenses on. But he's just a big bowl of tapioca pudding, man.
Mm-hmm.
He's got almost no range. Like, his wife leaves him, his wife comes back. He goes, like, I just never see him break any kind of emotional sweat. Love of his life, who's a Russian double, triple, quadruple agent. Like, goes in and out of his life. Like, just nothing moves him from anything.
Yeah. No, I'm with you.
And I think that they're trying to build on that as a character trait because he, you know, whatever fucked up shit he got up to when he was infiltrating the Ku Klux Klan or whatever he was doing.
Yeah. Scarred him.
It's nothing about, it's Noah Emmerich, right?
Yeah, the actor.
Sure. I've seen him in good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
This is all about the character as written, and I can't get excited for him. Another honorable mention, Rubber Drogon. Speaking of something to almost do, like, one of holy the classic shit. Holy shit moments in the entire books is reduced to giggles because for whatever reason, the green screen, the practical effects, Emilia Clarke's performance, mm-hmm. gingerly climbing on the bed. I think she's supposed to vault on the back of this beast and make him her own. She's just, you know, like, oh, I don't want to get, oh, that rubber horn is kind of pokey. Oh, no, I'm not sure if I can.
I mean, wasn't she for a while staying with, like, the most horse riding tribe in the land?
Yeah.
Like, she knows how to ride.
Right.
I assume a dragon is not that different, especially when you're its
you ride,
mother.
You ride a meat Drogo. It prepares you for the rubber Drogon. It should just be something you just boom, jump on. This is how we do things. Yeah.
And the compositing was just shockingly bad.
It's a never ending story.
I mean, that it was incredibly bad.
Like, she's just Atreyu-ing the shit out of this thing.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a joke. It can't possibly win this category, but man, does it deserve some
kind of attention. It's pretty bad. Pretty
attention.
Bad. Moving on to Best Boomerang of 2015. Now, this is a weird category. This is, Jim and I watch a lot of television outside of the normal framework of what we cover on Bald Move, and occasionally we uncover hidden gems from years gone by. That we want to talk about today. This category has Breaking Bad season 3. We both watched together as part of our summer series. We finished the full coverage of Breaking Bad.
Yeah,
Deep Space 9. You watched the whole thing
in its entirety.
Plowed through it on Netflix. Top of the Lake, the weird New Zealand based. Kind of sort of murder, child abduction mystery featuring Elizabeth Moss. Community, the NBC sitcom that desperately clung to life over many, many seasons of its life.
Mm-hmm.
And related, Harmontown, the documentary about the podcast that Dan Harmon, creator and head writer of Community, does in LA, and the traveling show that it turned into, and the dark, savage look into the heart of humanity.
Whew. Yeah.
You want to talk? I mean, so we decided we couldn't come to a clear agreement because neither one of us had watched all this stuff. We decided to split this up and that we can both make a recommendation. My Best Boomerang was Top of the Lake because I watched it almost immediately after I finished season 2 of True Detective, and it scratched that season 1 True Detective itch. This weird location,
gotcha. Yeah.
With weird characters and this mystery that you're trying to understand. And, you know, it's not, you know, I don't want you to set you up for like Cthulhu and you know, drug fueled
spirals in the sky
visions and single takes of, you know, an assault on a low income housing development in Louisiana. It's not that kind of thing, but it's got a lot of the same psychological feel for me. And I highly enjoy it. Highly recommend it. Came out in 2013. You can see the whole thing on Netflix. And you picked
Breaking Bad season 3.
Hard to argue. Obviously. One of the greatest seasons of one of the greatest shows on television.
Yeah, and you know, if you haven't watched it by now, nothing I'm going to say here is going to make you watch it.
Yeah,
you've heard it all before. Yeah. It's just, you know, the best thing I've watched and that was a Boomerang.
It's the show that launched Bald Move.
Sure.
Well, made it what it is today anyway. I have a hard time though, because this Harmontown thing,
mm-hmm.
So Harmontown, I watched Harmontown as a direct result of watching Rick and Morty. And then I came like, oh, this Dan Harmon's a really interesting dude. And I've since listened to 50 episodes of his podcast, probably like 1 through 41 easy. And I've done I jumped to the modern day because there's like 177 in his archive. Mm-hmm. I jumped to and like listened to the last 5 or 10. I watched the first 3 seasons of Community. I've watched a whole bunch of like Comic-Con panels and stuff about this and Rick and Morty. And I mean, like at least 100 hours of content in the last 2 months just because of fucking Rick and Morty and Harmontown.
Yeah. And that's a powerful argument.
I've gone through this just journey of like what it is to be Dan Harmon, and do I look up to him? Do I revile him?
You know what happens when you stare into the abyss, right?
It stares right back. Yeah, at one point in the middle of Harmontown, I remember texting you saying, I'm quitting Bald Move, mm-hmm. and I'm going to move to LA, and I'm going to become a Harmontown groupie. I'm going to become a yeah. Dan Harmon acolyte. I cooled down on that somewhat over the last 50 hours of content or so.
Okay.
But it's still, like, it was a fascinating journey, and I'm glad I went on it, and I still, Harmontown's something I look forward to every week. Anything you want to say about Deep Space Nine?
There's some real terrible shit in there.
There sure is. But
there's
a couple,
some real great shit too.
We watched a couple of the low lights, I guess. Ugh. And I've seen all of Deep Space Nine way back in the day, but I have completely blocked my memory.
Move along home.
Yeah,
that's
man.
All I can say. That episode is rotten. And I mean, I
didn't think that there was any episode as bad as the worst episodes from the first season of the Next Generation. But I don't know. That Let's Move Home episode was a cry for help.
It's terrible. Terrible on all levels. But yeah, I don't know. Deep Space Nine is a great show if you're into kind of the more military and political side of Star Trek, mm-hmm. and what that might be like. There are apparently some people who are deep into sci-fi who have not watched it. I listened to another sci-fi podcast that admitted last week to not having ever watched Deep Space Nine. Hmm. Which shocked the shit out of me because Star Trek Next Generation was one of their top 5 wow. sci-fi shows.
Yeah, how did
right?
you... I mean, I that's the thing with people. I mean, how old is this person? Because if they're in their
old enough to know better.
So if they're in their 30s, I don't see how you watch Star Trek The Next Generation and then noped out of Deep Space Nine. Because the final 2 seasons and the first 2 seasons of Deep Space Nine aired concurrently. Uh-huh. And there's a bit of crossover. Like, if nothing else, Worf came over on season 3, I think.
I mean, it starts with Patrick Stewart. Like,
yeah.
That first episode has Patrick Stewart in it.
In his most memorable, iconic role.
As Jean-Luc Picard.
As
sure.
Locutus of Borg. That's how it starts, doesn't it?
No. He gets on a conference call or a phone call,
But I thought the whole thing with Sisko was that he was mad at Jean-Luc because he somehow lost his wife at the Battle of Wolf 354.
Yeah, I guess it does have that in it too.
Okay.
The whole thing is his wife dying in that fire. Yeah.
Okay. But
but he also gets on a call with him as like modern day
sure.
Picard.
And I imagine that's a hard thing to do.
Sure. But yeah, that show's good.
You know, I always think that's interesting about science fiction shows where like people can inhabit your body and like do, or you have like the dark and light side of the force. Like, let's say the Anakin Skywalker got redeemed without dying. Mm-hmm. Does Anakin Skywalker serve in the Republic? And what does that look like?
Yeah.
Does he stand trial for his many, like you destroyed Alderaan. You have a trillion lives on your head.
Well, Tarkin did that.
But you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah, I do.
Like
yeah.
Jean-Luc Picard is the hero of the Federation, but he also got mind raped and was forced to fight against and destroy like 70.
I think they play with that idea in Next Generation, don't they?
Well, they always
like
play
a little bit.
They always play with the idea, yeah, because the Federation can't fully trust him because mm-hmm. He was susceptible to that. Yeah, I guess so, but not as much as I think they probably could have.
Yeah, certainly.
And I don't ever think they play with that in Deep Space Nine ever again, too. But whatever. Okay. Anything else you want to say before we move on?
If you're resistant to the idea that Deep Space Nine deals a lot with religion, know that I had that same issue and didn't see a problem with
Kai Wynn is the worst.
Yeah. No, she's the worst. She's a real asshole through the whole thing.
She really is.
But...
She's like the worst form of President Rosamund from, or is it Rosalind?
it makes it all the sweeter when you get a little comeuppance.
Yeah. Oh, God. shall we talk about best actress?
Sure.
Best female actor.
It's the lady who plays Kai Winn.
It's a Boomerang.
It's a Boomerang actress.
Bled out. Little leftovers heavy here. We've got Elizabeth Moss, in no particular order, Ann Dowd, Kirsten Dunst. I guess I should mention what these characters' names are. Ann Dowd, who plays Patty from The Leftovers. Elizabeth Moss, of course, who plays Peggy from Mad Men. Carrie Coon, who plays Nora from The Leftovers. Kirsten Dunst, who plays Peggy from Fargo. And Regina King, who plays Erica from The Leftovers. We've got three Leftovers actors up here. The winner is Regina King. And it was a really hard... It was between her and Carrie Coon.
Yeah.
Who I think for like a two-episode run in The Leftovers cemented their legacy as the doing the best work of anybody in this category in television. And it was a real... It came down... Why did Regina win over Carrie Coon?
I felt like her material was a little bit better this season.
Because in the most memorable episode, they went toe-to-toe with each other like as like a prize fight. And it was a what do you call that? A tie?
A draw?
A draw.
Yeah, it was
a split decision. It was amazing. A split decision. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, Carrie got to do some interesting stuff early. I think Regina got to do some interesting stuff late. But the tiebreaker was the work she did with her daughter in the finale episode. It's hard to talk about this without spoilers because I really hope, if nothing else, a lot more people go back and watch The Leftovers. But it's just amazing. It's just amazing what these people were able to do.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Carrie Coon has been extremely good this whole run. It's just Regina King, and maybe it's just the freshness of her coming in and doing her thing and giving us something different.
Yeah.
But I felt like she was, I don't know, just more affecting, I guess.
Yeah.
For me.
And again, anytime you can have like 5 minutes of television of just extreme close-ups of people's faces and it holds up to like, you know, not only are you not eye rolling, but you're just like hanging on every word.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the perfect direction and writing and performance coming together. And The Leftovers had this in spades this year. Beating a lot of worthy competition. I mean, Elizabeth Moss as Peggy had a lot of really nice moments in the final season of Mad Men. Kirsten Dunst really shined as Peggy. Mm-hmm. We wanted to you want to talk about Liv Taylor?
Liv Tyler. I want to talk about Elizabeth Taylor.
Liv Taylor, I think is how you pronounce her name.
Yeah, Liv Tyler for, you know, The Leftovers. She plays, what's her name?
Meg. Smegma.
She's surprising, you know, in a way that I didn't think Liv Tyler would ever be.
You would never use the word dangerous to describe a Liv Tyler.
Not at all.
Character. You would say cringeworthy involving animal crackers.
Mm-hmm.
You'd say
fun and wild in a bad Aerosmith video.
You'd say ethereal alongside and Alicia impenetrable in Lord of the Rings. But yeah, I mean, she played this kind of really dangerous, I think is the perfect word for her. Frightening character.
Definitely. And that was so far outside of what I thought her range was that I was impressed.
I want to go through the top 10 on these, their big categories, because there ended up being 27 on this list of the finalists. But Lena Headey, who plays Queen Cersei in Game of Thrones, had some of her best work yet. Kiernan Shipka, who plays Sally Draper on Mad Men, went toe-to-toe with Don Draper, John Hamm himself, and came out none the worse. Remarkable for as young as she is. I think she was 14 to 15 when she's filming this stuff. Christina Hendricks did a lot of fine work as Joan in the final season of Mad Men. Carrie Russell was muscled on here by Jim. She judo-chopped me, aided and abetted by Jim from The Americans. She plays Elizabeth, right, on The Americans? Yeah. And then Jamie Clayton got another Jim strong-armed. She plays Nomi on Sense8, the Netflix show.
Yeah, she's the best thing about that show.
Yeah. So lots of great stuff. And then I could go on for the next 10 and it's still all great stuff. But if you want to know more about that, you're going to have to check the bonus features. Best actor. The nominees, and again, no particular order. Kevin Caro plays John Murphy on The Leftovers. Wagner Moura, who plays Pablo Escobar in Netflix's Narcos. Rami Malek, who plays Elliot from Mr. Robot. Justin Theroux, who plays Kevin Garvey on The Leftovers. And John Hamm, who plays Don Draper in the finale season of Mad Men. Our winner, by a wide margin.
Carrie Coon. What?
Sure, why not? Moving on. Justin Theroux.
Yeah.
Justin Theroux, it was incredible.
Yeah.
That's the only thing I can describe. I can't imagine anyone else doing this and not being laughed out of the building. Like, the degree of difficulty of what he's being asked to do and how that kept on, like, you have to believe this character who's this contradiction and he's also got severe psychological problems. And he's also the voice of the audience sometimes. Mm-hmm. Like, the show will have this preposterous situation and he's the one like, this is stupid. I don't want to do this. And I mean, I don't know what I can say to make people watch the fucking Leftovers, but it's, we cannot stop, you know, giving props to the show.
Yeah, I mean,
we were kind of embarrassed, honestly, at how much it dominated the actors and other awards upcoming.
Yeah, we're self-conscious wondering, are we putting too much Leftovers in here? But honestly, those are the performances, and like, that's the thing about that show. Like, everything comes together, and the performances are, it's all on the back of the performances, right? Like,
sure,
you couldn't do this without really, really good actors.
Yep. And, you know, again, John Hamm, excellent as Don Draper, and a fitting in and a surprising in. Like, if you'd have told me beginning the season that he would end up the way, I would have probably been mad to outraged. Mm-hmm. But it felt natural, and it felt like what needed to happen. Wagner Moura, as Pablo Escobar, was awesome. Like,
utterly convincing.
And a very, you know, again, the I say again, because this is all stuff we talked about in deliberations, but for the first time, I'll remark that just his drugstore cowboy, pothead, ruthless drug dealer is a interesting character. And to the extent that it's based on reality, I mean, truth stranger than fiction.
Yeah.
Narcos is this really interesting tale of how drug dealers very nearly took over a country. And also, there's still a lot more of that story to come out. Maybe they do. Spoiler alert.
You know who doesn't win Best Actor?
Who?
Would never win Best Actor?
Rubber Drogon.
Robert Durst.
That's a true statement. That's a true statement. And I tell you what, it was the actual order that we arrived at for the top five was Justin Theroux, John Hamm, Wagner Moura, Kevin Carroll, who respected... Why did Kevin Carroll fall that low?
Well, I don't like his character.
It was hard to relate to him for us.
He's a real asshole in the show.
Yeah.
that doesn't help him. That doesn't do him any favors.
Yeah.
I don't know. His character just didn't have that much punch for me. I was just like, meh, it's okay. Shockingly, Christopher Eccleston not even making the pool of nominees
top
here.
Five. Yeah, though he was like, if we're going to finish this out, we went Rami Malek as number five. Christopher Eccleston was six, who plays Matt on The Leftovers. Bokeem Woodbine, memorably playing Mike Milligan in Fargo. He's the highest-ranking Fargo guy. Vincent Kartheiser, who plays Pete on Mad Men. You're a rational crusade to get him some love.
Man, I like him. I like the actor because I hate the character.
And I am surprised that I liked the way that Pete ended up, I guess.
Okay.
Again, if you'd have told me that had happened before... Mm-hmm. I would have been outraged, but the show earned its moments, man. Bob Odenkirk for Better Call Saul, the titular role of Saul, or Jimmy McGill, as he's known in the series. It's a big surprise there.
As a
like,
dramatic
we knew he was
actor,
solid.
Yeah.
We didn't know he was that solid.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he can win an episode by coming in and being a smartass and sarcastic and this badass sure. gangland lawyer, but could he carry a whole... Yes, he can carry a whole season. He can probably carry a whole series.
Yeah.
Then Patrick Wilson, who played Lou Salverson from Fargo, rounding out our top 10. And it's murderer's row. I mean, Oscar Isaac as Nick Wasisco was got strong from Show Me a Hero, got strong consideration. Michael McKean, the brother of Saul, from also got serious consideration. So let's move on. Anything else you want to say about the actors before we get to our shallowest field, the best documentary?
Mm.
And the nominees are Going Clear, Mythbusters, and The Jinx. Let's not be late. Again, The Jinx by a mile. And why?
Yeah. The Jinx is has one of the most jaw-dropping endings of anything I've ever seen, period. Like, I can't think of another more shocking moment in television history.
And if you've managed to get this far without it being spoiled, you need to go to HBO or HBO Go or On Demand or what, however, the Pirate Bay. Yeah. You need to download the series and watch it because it is, it's just amazing. It's what Serial wished it was.
Uh-huh.
And it's just really, really good. And it's going against Going Clear, the other documentary that we are predisposed. Like, if you got a hard-hitting, investigative, journalistic piece on a exploitative, dangerous religion, mm-hmm. that's our bread and butter. That's our mother's milk. We're all about that. And The Jinx handily beat it. Handily beat it. I threw Mythbusters because last season they did something different. They got rid of the junior Mythbusters and they went to a more cinematic deep dive on the actual builds and process that Jamie and Adam, the two hosts, do. That, you know, if you've been living under a rock, you don't know Mythbusters is a reality-based show on Discovery where they try to figure out, for example, could a man dying of cancer cobble together an automatic machine gun device will pop out of a trunk and kill a bunch of neo-Nazis
uh-huh.
in a particular episode of television with just a garage door opener, a Cadillac, and a machine gun. And they built it and it worked.
The answer is yes.
Yes.
Yes, he could.
Myth confirmed. and they do a lot of cool stuff like that.
Yeah.
And they've been on for 14 years. It's their final season coming up. I think this week, maybe even.
Sweet.
So yeah, pretty excited about that, and I thought that when they got rid of the Tory Grant and Carrie that it would suck massively, but I actually think it was one of those rare cases of addition by subtraction, giving the main stories bigger, more room to the grow and really blow up the production values did a lot for the show. Shall we go on to our top comedies of the year?
Yeah.
Our top five, and again, in no particular order, Key and Peele's final season, Parks and Rec final season, Silicon Valley, Rick and Morty, and Always Sunny in Philadelphia. And this was a very intense debate, but the winner at the end was Rick and Morty. Rick and Morty is an animated science fiction show on the Cartoon Network. Its second season came out this year, and that's kind of when it blew up for me. I just out of nowhere had all these friends saying, you got to watch Rick and Morty. I hear all these references I'm not understanding. Its premise is essentially imagine Doc Brown and Marty McFly from Back to the Future. That's crazy scientist and naive young teenage boy, except for now Doc Brown is Marty's grandfather, and he lives with him with his family. And he can go through time and dimensions of space. It's like it's Doc Brown and Doc Who put together, and it's incredible. Like, take it from here, Jim. What is so great about the show?
It's funny.
It's super funny.
It's real funny. It has outlandish concepts, which somehow get you to think about the implications of those concepts sure. in a way that you're not used to.
Like multiverse theory, time paradoxes, like yeah. really old hoary tropes. It likes to pull apart and consider not just the philosophical, but the ethical ramifications of these.
And sometimes even practical. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, it's very thought-provoking.
And a lot of surprisingly hard science fiction concepts, too.
Uh-huh. And it also has some kind of heart to it. You know, it's dealing with a lot of issues that are not time and space related, yeah, but you, are like family.
If you sit down to watch the show, you're going to be like halfway through season one being like, what fucking Heart? This is the anti-Heart show.
Well, Rick is not a heartfelt character for the most part.
No, and the family's mostly terrible, and they kind of, you know, but it finds a heart and a healthy dose of continuity somewhere in season two, and I think elevates it from just, you know, a yuck, funny kind of show to something that I spent a lot of time thinking about and led me single-handedly onto my Harmon quest. So it's got that going for it.
Yeah. But, and while I did have probably better laughs in Silicon Valley, it didn't do those other things that Rick and Morty does.
We had some, Silicon Valley, why did it, because we debated this back and forth, because I will freely admit that Silicon Valley is approximately as funny as Rick and Morty. I want to say Rick and Morty is slightly funnier, but I did watch both seasons back to back, whereas, you know, Silicon Valley, I just watched the one season, and sometimes that stuff, like same with Always Sunny, I watched all of Always Sunny this year, because I'd never seen it.
Yeah.
I was trying to constantly discount Always Sunny because a lot of these funny moments, I was like, oh, well, that's actually from 10 seasons worth of stuff I watched, not just the one. Why did Rick and Morty win over Silicon Valley? Or why? What's the case for Silicon Valley?
The other things that it does. Well, I've made the case for Silicon Valley, and you can go listen to it in the deliberation stuff that we did.
The Silicon Cliff Notes.
But ultimately, I think, you know, Silicon Valley is good for me in a way that it might not be good for other people. And also, it doesn't have any bigger questions that it's asking, any other issues that it raises. I don't want to say one note because it's not one note exactly, but if it had one note, that one note would be comedy.
Huh.
And Rick and Morty has a little bit more than that. It was also a really good year for It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. And that show, man, I love those characters. I love to hate those characters. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like they're despicable and they're evil and they're doing horrible things all the time. But right. I really like them.
We had some honorable mentions. Danger 5. Pitch Danger 5 to people.
It's Charlie's Angels with the guy with an eagle head. I haven't seen season 2.
Sure.
So season 1 to me is... It's set in like the 60s or the 70s?
Like an alternate reality 60s where
Hitler
has not been definitively, the Nazis are still a thing, and the forces of good, the multinational forces of good. You got a Frenchman, I think a Russian, two Brits, and an American are the Danger Five, and they are waging a five-man and woman war on Hitler.
Yeah.
And the episode is set up that you got this colonel who is literally a man in a suit. He's wearing an eagle head. He comes in, he debriefs the team, and he says that you must kill Hitler every fucking episode. Mm-hmm. And then it's weird because it's
so hard
filmed,
to describe.
Yeah,
the
it's
show.
Filmed like in very like that's exactly what an Italian schlocky exploitative spy thriller would look like from the 70s.
Yeah.
Like, have you seen the Diabolique, that was sampled heavily in Beastie Boys' Body Moving video? Mm-hmm. Like, it's if you've seen Diabolique, it's very much up that alley. The lips are intentionally, it looks like everything's poorly dubbed.
Yeah.
A lot of plots don't make sense. The sets and miniatures and FX work is shoddy, but hilariously so. Pretty good. And then season 2, which actually came out this year, which is why it's eligible for the list, it seems to essentially, each episode is a different type of 80s movie thing. Like there's a Night of the Living Dead schlocky science fiction zombie episode. There's a Mighty Morphin Power Rangers episode. There's a, you know, a Miami Vice type episode. It's everything. It's the same kind of concept. They're still trying to kill Hitler. There is a Hitler goes back to high school and tries to be a popular kid episode. It's a lot more uneven, but it's equally hilarious. And it gets an honorable mention. You should check it out. 7 Days of Hell.
Yeah,
the
that's
one
a,
shot. What do you? Would you? It's not a mini.
It's a mockumentary.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Yeah, made by Andy Samberg, and it's got Jon Snow in
Kit
it. Harington.
Yep.
playing against type, I guess.
Sure.
And it's ridiculous in all the ways that you imagine an Andy Samberg thing would be.
Honestly, I thought it was better than I was hotly anticipating this based on just the previews.
Yeah.
And you know, the kind of setup is Andy Samberg is an Andre Agassi type.
Yeah.
Whereas Kit Harington is the prodigy, like this child has been put on the planet to play tennis and that's all he's known in his entire life.
Yeah.
And this
he's more of the Pete Sampras.
This epic game, which is kind of, I guess, it was probably inspired by that Roger Federer Nadal match that we actually watched. We got wrapped up in real life, but it's essentially a game that lasts for 7 days in Wimbledon.
Yeah, and it's just hilariously bad. And I don't know. I don't know
best
how to describe
use of
this.
Dolph like, Lundgren in like the last decade.
yeah. It's got good Dolph. It's got. A really bizarre animated scene with cock that stretches for days. It's
sure.
Like,
yeah, like
he goes to print, like all this stuff is real weird.
Yes.
But it's real funny.
Yeah. But I mean, again, if you like Rick and Morty, if you like Danger 5, you'll like 7 Days of Hell. And conversely, if you like 7 Days of Hell, this is like one of these litmus tests. If you like any of these two movies, you'll probably like the third one.
Yeah. Yeah.
Unless you're the weird guy that's going to prove the exception proves the rule. Shall we round out the top 10 was Rick and Morty, Silicon Valley, Parks and Rec, Always Sunny, Key and Peele, Danger 5, Louie, which I had a perfectly fine but is increasingly less funny and more like poignant and kind of looks at society at large. 7 Days of Hell, Master of None, the Netflix series, the Aziz and Azari. Is that how I pronounce his name?
Aziz Ansari, yeah.
And Orange is the New Black, with Archer narrowly missing the cut for the top 10. So there you go. There's our best comedy. And the number one, the reason people have been tuning in and listening, best television show. This was a brutal, brutal, brutal topic. I think we're going to talk about the top 10. We definitely got a lot of honorable mentions to talk about. The top five, in no particular order, Mr. Robot, Better Call Saul, The Leftovers, Mad Men, and Narcos. The winner is, of course, The Leftovers.
How could it not be?
Yeah. It's weird that I know there are people out there that just cannot believe that we're loving the show as much as we do.
Sure.
And I don't know what to say because, you know, it's like I imagine the way you feel about it the way I feel about the Americans. You know, and if the Americans won, I'd be like, I just don't get it. I don't enjoy the experience of watching the show. But I feel sorry for you because, unfortunately, it was the best thing on television in 2015. And not even by a little bit.
No, the competition wasn't that close,
and
frankly.
But that's the thing. The competition is incredibly strong. This just was on a whole other level. This was like Michael Jordan in his prime. Like, yeah, Charles Barkley's pretty good. But you're going to take Michael Jordan, first, second, third pick in any kind of dream team draft. So what are you going to do?
Sure.
And that's how I felt about it. It remains to be seen whether it can dethrone The Wire for like best series ever, but first
or
two seasons,
the Breaking Bad.
Shit. Yeah. Breaking Bad. If you're Jim.
Yeah.
Jones.
I mean, like I stand by my statement. I think that was the best season of television I've ever seen.
Right.
Season one, not quite as good.
We now know we're getting one more season and one more season only.
Yeah.
It's the final season.
Which is a good idea.
I think so too. And I have very, very high expectations. In fact, this show's its own worst enemy now.
Yep.
Because how can they top?
Biggest disappointment, 2016.
This was our number three show last year. And our big fear was, wow, what if Lindelof gives in to his, inner demons and blah, blah. No. In fact, there's no need to stretch this out. Like, I'm really fully expecting them to top themselves again. And, this damn show, like, it starts off at about approximately 10,000 BCE. How do you pull something like that off? How do you pull off multiple dream sequences and levels of... I mean, it's like all the worst things of Inception and any Devil Temptation movie you've seen, and any Split Personality, and somehow it juggles them all and says something important about what it is to be human, and made me feel real human emotions, which is always notable.
Sure.
What else can we say about it?
Nothing.
Let's give some love to all the top five. Mr. Robot.
Another excellent show. It was, so it's above Better Call Saul, right? If we're ranking them on a list.
Yeah.
I don't know if we want to make this a pool or a list, but it might be surprising considering where our best debut landed. But like I said there,
that's,
I think,
where you have the biggest surprise interacts with the best debut, and the surprise factor wins.
Yeah. And I think, you know, Mr. Robot has a lot of promise for the future. I don't think it was quite as strong as Better Call Saul, because Better Call Saul didn't really have that... that single character that we were just like, oh my god, no. But the ideas that it put in place could really go somewhere. Mm-hmm. And so that to me is a big factor in what makes a good show. Am I thinking about it after the fact? Am I really excited to see where it goes from here?
See, that's the thing. I'm terrified, because at the end of Mr. Robot, I saw no clear path going forward. And yet the show producers are saying this was just our prologue. This is the setup, the story that we want to tell. And I'm like, what the hell does that look like?
Yeah.
And I don't know. It's a little bit Lost-ish. It's a little bit X-File-ish when you make a statement like that. And I've got my shields up. So I'm very curious to see what they come back with. Hopefully this year.
Yeah, I'm excited for it.
Better Call Saul. I mean, you know, we have full coverage of that. What more do you want? It was not exactly a pleasant surprise, but it was professionals doing television at a very high professional level with a lot of heart, a lot of comedy. If that's something you were missing in the final seasons of Breaking Bad, I think arguably a more successful overall season than season one of Breaking Bad.
Yeah, quite possibly.
You can't, I mean, I'm saying it arguably as literally the definition of that word. You can make the argument and not be laughed out of court.
Yeah. Although Jimmy McGill cannot. He will be laughed at every time.
Yeah, he will.
But then he'll go to the men's room and
he'll harangue the prosecutor until he drops it for a lesser charge.
But yeah, it's a strong contender as far as first seasons go on
sure.
Vince Gilligan shows.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of people doing a lot of excellent work. You know, we talked about Lenny from, I forget what his name, Charles McKean. What the hell was this guy's name?
Hamlin? Are you talking about Hamlin? No.
We talked about Michael McKean.
Oh, Chuck? Yeah.
But Jonathan Banks is right there, too. I mean, you know, we knew, again, Jonathan Banks could steal a few scenes. But could he carry an entire episode where he's the emotional center of it?
He did. Yeah, but ultimately it was one episode, and we were like, eh.
Sure.
Not big enough part to matter.
But excellent work from everyone all around. Mad Men, what can you say about Mad Men? It wrapped up, it stuck the landing.
It did its Mad Men thing, and that's all we kind of wanted from it,
right? One of the higher degrees of difficulty for ending a show, because it was so nebulous, and so many people had different ideas of what would be the perfect Mad Men ending. And... Yeah. You know, it was true to its characters. It left everyone in a, not maybe the best state, but the state that they probably belonged in. And it was a wonderful piece of cinema from start to finish. Narcos, number five. Why was this so good?
I think it was largely on the back of Wagner Moura.
Yeah.
Guy playing Pablo. I think he did a fantastic job. And the story itself is just very gripping. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not hard to tell this story in a compelling way.
Yeah.
You know?
I think I would have been more blown away by this show if I hadn't have read the book Killing Pablo and seen two separate documentaries on his life. Because I think a lot of the early going was just carried by people. I mean, imagine if you were ignorant of that, it's just shocking.
Yeah.
Like what this guy got up to and got away with, and the things that he and the rest of the cartel was doing as far as the politics of the situation. And then when you started getting off into Killing Pablo starts off, I think, right around the time, like it has like 50 pages of this kind of background information. Then it launches right into the hunt for him immediately after the prison sequence in this season, and that's what they're coming back with season two. So the best parts of my favorite book on the subject are going to be mined for this upcoming segment. I'm pretty excited about it.
Yeah, the thing that really, I think, brought it over the edge for me was his kind of battle against the government.
And sure.
A battle against incarceration.
Yeah.
And how he had so much influence and power there that what could they do but kind of let him create his own prison?
Yeah, and you know, anytime...
Do whatever he wanted, essentially.
And I was going back and forth about rooting for this guy, rooting for him to fail, wondering if Columbia would be better off if maybe it was a narco state. Mm-hmm. Like, what if this guy had turned legitimate as a politician? Would you know, would he have just done it? Probably what had happened, he's just used it to make himself more obscenely powerful and wealthy.
Sure.
Which would have been bad news Jay-Z, for right? a lot of different people. But you know, there's always the hope that maybe the little guys and little girls at the bottom would improve from his largesse dripping off his table. But I don't know, like, but the fact that I was wondering that, I thought was interesting. Shall we have some honorable mentions? Number six, just missing the cut. Show Me a Hero. The latest David Simon joint on a late 80s, early 90s court battle between the city of Yonkers and the federal government. The city of Yonkers was fighting low income and subsidized public housing, because everybody knows that means projects, and everybody knows that means drug dealers and scary people and murders and cop cars. And it's a 6-episode run about the mayor of Yonkers fight to initially he was opposed, but by the end he was trying to ram this through for lots of different reasons. It's about the community, about the people that oppose the public housing, it's about the people that desperately needed the public housing, and it's like The Wire played fast forward. Like, it compresses 6 or 5 seasons of what's wrong with American politics and civil planning and communities and everything into 6 episodes, and it's amazing. It's amazing.
It is, yeah. And I mean, the guy, what is it, Oscar? Isaac,
yep. Who you probably have seen as Poe.
That's right, at this point,
what's
everyone's
his name?
Seen him.
Poe, I don't know. Poe Didgeridoo.
Poe Didgeridoo, the X-Wing pilot.
From the new
from
Force
Star
Awakening
Wars movies.
Yep.
Yeah. He's great in it, and I think. So this show is not as entertaining as a lot of these other shows, which is always a David Simon problem for me.
Not only is it not entertaining, the first 2 episodes are almost punishing in how much it just, like, you're thrown in a situation you don't know why you should care. You know who the good guys are, the bad guys, a bunch of unrelated characters that literally are unrelated to anything going on the plot.
Yeah, for
and
a while.
Follow this as it all converges in the next 6 episodes.
And that's the other thing, right? That's another... So David Simon is not particularly entertaining most of the time, but he's also extremely thought-provoking. And that's where this show really shines. And it didn't quite make top 5 because it's just not entertaining enough, but man, it's worth watching.
Yeah, and it does. You will walk away with a deeper appreciation for a lot of things about politics and, you know, some of the finer points about the different cultural battles we face and fight in America, mm-hmm. and just how fucked up the political process is.
Sure.
And I don't know. And that's the things, like, David Simon is really good at pointing these things out. And then how do you fix it? I don't know, but it seems like the consistent answer is we have to fix it. It's not the politicians are going to do it. We have to take care of each other and, you know, be more thoughtful and not accept the standard stories about anything and, like, question our assumptions and, you know, just because one plan fails. But that's the infuriating thing, right? It's not like that's the game of politics. Is not only do you fight on the open marketplace for your ideas, then if the other guy wins, you have the second round of trying to fuck up his idea so bad that it fails. So then you can say his idea was bad all together.
Sure.
Like in my Philosopher King scenario, like, you know, when one ideology loses, then it's like, okay, but for the good of the country, we're going to give it everything we can and try to make sure this other ideology succeeds. And if it fails on its merits, then fine. It fails on its merits. We'll have learned something. But that's not how it works.
Nope.
And it's terrible, but I don't know what to do about it.
Maybe David Simon does. Maybe we can ask him.
I don't think he does. That's why he keeps making these movies. He's like, this is fucked up. We should do something about it.
Just let's all make Amsterdam happen.
He actually does have some. There's some. I'm actually damning it with faint solutions. I think that there actually are some solid solutions that are, and I was completely ignorant of. As much as I've tried to inform myself about this war on drugs and poverty and all that stuff, I did not know about some of this low income and public housing options and how, you know, they don't have to be just hellhole projects. They can, and why do they become hellhole projects? It's essentially the tragedy of the commons on a grand scale. Like, of course it happens this way, and it would happen regardless of how you did it, you know? It happened with 16th century sheep herders in England, and it's going to happen in Baltimore when you have the same conditions.
Sure.
It's really interesting. Let's talk about Daredevil, another honorable mention.
Yeah,
the show that single-handedly got you to give a shit about Netflix's superhero efforts.
Yeah, unexpectedly. Like, I've talked about this before, but I turned it on intending to, like, everybody's going to be talking about this. I might as well just watch it while I'm doing other shit. So turn it on, like, halfway through I think into the beginning of the second episode, I was like, oh, boy, I better actually pay attention to this thing because it's really good. And then, you know, it single-handedly made me give a shit about watching Jessica Jones. I never, ever would have done that. Daredevil is definitely worth your time. Even if you just like awesome fight choreography, Daredevil's worth your time. There are a couple of good fights in there.
Let's use this as a springboard to talk about Jessica Jones, which we haven't talked as much about.
Yeah.
Honestly, I thought a lot of the problems that, and a lot of people said that Jessica Jones is better than Daredevil, and I can see why they say that. A lot of
those people are wrong.
I will say that I think Jessica Jones has one of the greatest comic book villains of all time.
Okay.
And I think Magneto's still the best because he is a little bit more relatable. But honestly, the more I think about this Kilgrave character, the more inevitable it seems that he would turn out the way he did. Like, he is cursed with these powers that so warps your perception and what you think of as good and evil, and the fact that it's an unconscious reflex thing that happens. This is not a spoiler to say that he can, because it's dealt with immediately. His superpower is anything that he suggests, other people within earshot must comply with. So, like, hey, go get me a Coke, Jim Joe. You would just go do it, and you'd have to. You'd be compelled. And how, if you're a child that discovers that you have these powers, what does that do to you? Can you become a heroic individual with those powers?
Yeah, I'm sure you could. There's a path.
But you can also go really, really dark places with those characters. And it uses it as a tool to talk about, the trite battle of the sexes. It uses it to talk a lot of interesting things about what it is to be a survivor of sexual assault or any kind of abuse and control situation. And it's got a really interesting, thought-provoking villain, which so did Daredevil. But it's weird because I felt like that the Kingpin in Daredevil was one of its greatest strengths, but there was something a little bit off that I couldn't really connect with about that particular version of the Kingpin. But on the other hand, the big flaw of Jessica Jones is they have this character who is a existential threat to essentially everyone in the Marvel Comics universe. So as soon as he's introduced, it's not like Jessica Jones is going to be like, all right, well, I'm going to go rescue kittens from trees, or I'm going to do this low rent superpower detective agency stuff. Like, all effort has to be on stopping him. They introduce him very early in the season, which means that they have about 8 episodes worth of plot and they got 13 episodes to fill. They could have done 4, 5, 6, you know, standard mini, like, standalone episodes where Jessica Jones goes around solving crimes and getting into misadventures. Maybe, you know, kind of like the way they did the Kingpin in Daredevil. The Kilgrave is skulking around in the background, reveals himself in the midpoint, and then they have the final, you know, titanic battle over the next 7 episodes. But they didn't, and it really fatally fucks up the structure.
Yeah, there's a lot I don't like about Jessica Jones as a show, but there's a lot to like.
What are the things you don't like that they're not directly stem from them trying to fill, you know, eight episodes worth of show in a 13 episode season?
I don't think they did enough to flesh out her friend, the blonde news anchor or whatever.
Sure. Former child star turned
she should have given
vaguely Oprah figure, I guess.
She deserved a little bit more attention than they gave her. I don't know. That show meanders in a way that, like, it's not just the Kilgrave stuff that's kind of repetitious and overwrought. It's also like the stuff with Luke Cage that gets a little repetitious.
Really?
There's a lot I don't like about this show, which is why it's not as high as Daredevil for me. Mm. But the questions that it's raising and the things it has to say about social issues and stuff is far more poignant than Daredevil ever would be.
Well, the other thing is, like, I felt like that the stunt work on Daredevil was on a whole other level, whereas Jessica Jones, I mean, part of that's by design. Jessica Jones is a super powered person. She is super strong. She can jump super high. I think she's not well nigh invulnerable, but she can take a punch better than most. So she's just like, you know, her versus a street thug is borderline bullying behavior.
Yeah.
Whereas you've got a blind man trained to the point to physical perfection. Seems like, you know, the him versus three street toughs, that's a believable battle that he could lose. It's a lot more Batman. He's just a regular old Joe getting by with his wits and guile and a little bit of a superpower. Yeah. Whereas she's just the Incredible Hulk in the frame of Christian Ritter.
Maybe that's one of the other things I don't like about it is it's too much superhero shit. For me,
very little superhero shit though. They could have gone all out on some fight scenes, and they do towards the end, but
a couple times, yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't want to do too many spoilers, but there was a point in this series where I noped out. Uh-huh. I have not finished season one.
Oh, you
of
still
this.
Haven't finished the last two
no,
episodes?
And I don't know that I will. We'll see. Yeah, I'll have to hear about season two because, like I said, a lot of problems with the show structurally. It's still interesting.
So where are you at? Because next on the plate is Luke Cage, and then after that is the Iron Fist, and then after that, supposedly, they're going to have a B squad Avengers.
Does Luke Cage
Defenders.
Have anything interesting in his story other than I'm a bartender who
I'm sure
is invulnerable and strong?
I don't know. I know nothing about the character.
And neither do I.
But I thought the actor was very interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought the idea of him just going around kicking ass would be kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. Maybe it'll be a shit show. And
I mean, if he's just bouncing people out of his bar every week, I don't want to see Cheers with an invulnerable,
Patrick
super
Swayze
strong
got
bartender.
Got a good solid 2 hours out of that concept.
You're right. Roadhouse, if that whole season is just Roadhouse, an extended cut.
Yeah,
I'm good.
Maybe he travels.
Maybe I do want to see that.
Maybe he travels around the bar to bar, like, you know, the Coolers do. Their fraternity and then he finally gets a bar of his own at the end, and that's how we meet him in Jessica Jones.
He kills a man. He bounces the bartender right out.
So what are you going to do? You're going to wait till I watch it and tell you whether it's good or okay? Well,
yeah.
Fuck. another honorable mention you want to talk about, Sense8 on Netflix.
Oh, yeah. This surprised the shit out of me because it's made by the Wachowskis, who, you know, I had immense respect for coming out of The Matrix, even kind of all of The Matrix. Like, the sequels aren't as good, obviously, as the original, but still, a lot of good stuff to like about that. Then they did a string of movies that I didn't give a shit about.
Speed Racer? You weren't on for Speed Racer? Cloud Atlas? Didn't like Cloud
Speed
Atlas?
Racer was the most bizarre decision after The Matrix that I could have ever possibly imagined.
Jupiter Ascending. There's nothing wrong with that show.
Yeah, Dogface Channing Tatum. that's right up my alley.
I actually enjoyed Cloud Atlas, I just want to point out.
I haven't seen it.
Okay.
But I don't expect much from them, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they came out with this sci-fi premise of like these eight people who are all connected through some kind of psychic dimensional link.
Where, do they ever explain the science behind that at all?
They don't.
Okay.
No.
That's probably for the best.
And I don't know that they need to. Yeah,
probably
it's more of a
best.
Fantasy than a sci-fi,
sure,
I guess.
Sure.
But the thing that I like about the show is not the plot necessarily, but it's how the plot ties into the social issues that they're talking about with gender and sexuality. And they have a lot of different characters that kind of are all along the spectrum.
Sure. Just
period. Like, you've got a transgendered woman, you've got a gay man, you've got a bunch of straight people. Like, it's all over the board. Mm-hmm. So the really cool thing about
it is... I've seen a few episodes, like the first three or so.
Okay. Did you see the one with the Four Non-Blondes song?
I wouldn't...
Because holy shit, that moment is good.
I know, I don't...
That moment is real good.
Because my girlfriend Cecily was watching it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know if she finished it or not, too.
It's good. The way that they use, like, this idea of these people who are connected and all very different says something about the world in general and society and how we should all kind of, you know, come together and we can accomplish more than we could without that link. The message there is really cool, and it plays out in a really cool way. So, like, plot maybe not perfect, but there's so much more in that show to like.
Okay, so if we want to give the top 10 for this year, it is in reverse order: Game of Thrones barely hanging on at the number 10 slot, The Nick squeaked in at the strength of its ending to number 9, Fargo number 8, Daredevil number 7, Show Me Here number 6, Narcos 5, Mad Men 4, Better Call Saul 3, Mr. Robot 2, and the winner and champion, presumed champion going into next year, is The Leftovers.
Yeah, the winner of kind of everything.
Winner, yeah.
If it had a couple more laughs, it would have been comedy of the year too.
But you know what? I think that it had the exact right amount of laughs. It had any more laughs, kidding, it would have lapsed into parody. All right.
Yeah.
That's my superpower, is I can't process sarcasm in a real-time podcast. I have to any rhetorical question asked, I must answer.
Yeah, A. Ron Hubbard coming to Netflix.
Yeah.
2017.
And that's it. That's the wrap up for 2015. It's in the books. It's done. Excited to see. I mean, there's a couple of some things on my radar right away, like the Westworld.
Yeah.
That looks ambitious AF.
It might fall on its fucking face.
It might, but I'm glad someone's trying it, because it looks tasty.
Yep.
Looks very tasty.
I hear good things about...
Plus all the Netflix, the Marvel, and I know you're not excited for it, but I am amped up for the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I'm ready for Luke Cage. I'm ready for Iron Fist. I'm ready for Defenders. I'm ready for season 2 of Daredevil.
What's the name of that show that Chad Coleman went to?
The Expanse.
The Expanse. Yeah, I'm hearing good things about that. I got to check it out.
I'm going to check it out just because my dad's on it. It's the sci-fi pedigree.
Sure.
That scares me, because
I understand
their best thing they ever did, Battlestar, was a land like a wet fart for me. So,
man, I love Battlestar. All right.
But yeah, hopefully you've enjoyed this. You can argue with us about it on the forums at forums.baldmove.com. And again, we've got hours upon hours of us debating and arguing and giving our viewpoints. If you'd like to see, check out our work, it's probably enough to keep you busy for a week or so. Certainly it did for us.
Yeah.
But yeah, great 2015. Here's to a great 2016. And until 2016's over, I'm your host, Aaron.
I'm Jim. See you.
Bye.